The Guardian. This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, supported by audible.co.uk, Syrian rebels sidetracked by the scramble for spoils of war. Beijing spends $1 billion to get China rocking. And Werner Herzog reflects on a life in film. And in our audiobook review, we bring you the debut novel from a writer of comics who converted to Islam in G. Willow Wilson's Aleph the Unseen, and a globe-trotting journey in Benjamin Gilmore's Paramedico. To download or stream The Guardian Audio Edition for free, go to audible.co.uk/guardian or find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
A very happy new year and welcome back to the first Science Weekly of 2013 with me, Ian Sample.
The bad reaction was the head of my laboratory who came to my office one day and said to me, Danny, you are a disgrace to my group. I want you to leave my group. I cannot be with you in the same group.
We kick off the new year with an extended feature interview with the Nobel laureate, Professor Daniel Schechtman, whose discovery in the early 1980s of the existence of quasi-periodic crystals landed him the top prize in science in 2011. But it was not an easy ride for Schechtman. So counterintuitive was his discovery to many scientists in the field that he was publicly besmirched by another Nobel laureate, the great Linus Pauling, who said of Schechtman's discovery, quote, "There is no such thing as quasi-crystals, only quasi-scientists." However, Pauling was wrong, and Schechtman's discoveries spawned a new field in material science. When Alok Jha met with Professor Schechtman, he discussed at length his often lonely battle to gain wider acceptance of his novel discovery, and also his insight into the nature of how new science can challenge orthodoxy. But first, Alok asked what happened the morning he got the call from the Nobel Committee in Sweden.
On October 5 of 2011, I was sitting in my office at the Technion. I'm a professor in the Department of Materials Engineering there. And at 11:15, the telephone rang. And I pick up the phone nonchalantly. It says, Danny speaking in Hebrew. And the phone says, hello? This is the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Please hold the line. Very important message. So I said, uh-oh. And then the people from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences come in. They told me that I won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And then they wanted to talk to me further and told me to hold the line. But then the line, and then they said, then the line was disconnected. And then they said, okay, they called again. We will call you again after we announce it. Don't talk to anybody for half an hour. 15 minutes to 12, they announce it to the world. And so I was sitting there in my office, left my computer, looking at the floor and thinking, what does it mean? What will happen now? And I had all kinds of things running through my head, and I was so way off because the explosion that follows the Nobel Prize announcement is unbelievable, and I will detail that later on.
So you had half an hour of normal life left. And what did you do in that half an hour? Did you stay silent? Did you tell anyone?
I waited for 20 minutes and then called my wife because she is always very mad at me when I don't tell her about my prizes ahead of time. And she was elated. I asked her, are you alone? She said, no, I'm with a student. She's a professor in the Haifa University. And I said, well, I want to tell you that I won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Don't tell anybody. So that was my first conversation, 10 minutes ahead of time. And then at 15 minutes to 12, there was the announcement. And 5 minutes later, hell broke loose. Because so many started to stream to my office, congratulating, shouting and screaming and hugging and kissing. It was unbelievable. And the corridor was full of people who tried to get into my office, could not get in because it was so full. And the president of my university came running and the chair of my department and everybody else. So this was the beginning. And then what happened was the Technion organized a press conference right away. Within an hour or two, there was a press conference with many photographers and television crews and journalists. And so this was the beginning of a long journey. The Nobel Prize is a phase transformation in one's life. You change your life within 1 minute from pre-Nobel to post-Nobel, and it means so much. I did not know that day they announced the Nobel Prize in chemistry. I never knew when they announced the Nobel Prizes anyway. But in physics, people told me, you know, Danny, it's tomorrow.
So you were maybe thinking
I
physics
said,
one.
What is tomorrow? The prize. Oh, the announcement is tomorrow. About physics, I never thought it was. I was even a candidate for chemistry. But later on, when I thought about it, crystallography usually goes to chemistry. I should have thought about it. And I know that I was a candidate. I was nominated for the prize years before that, quite a few times. But in fact, I never really expected to really win the prize. You know, I always appreciate the fact that the Nobel Prize committees choose the right scientist. Everybody that receives the Nobel Prize deserves to receive it, but not everybody that deserves to receive the Nobel gets it.
What were you planning to do that day? You must have had a plan of action for that afternoon, which was obviously thrown into disarray.
Well, answering emails, preparing a talk to my students, talk to my graduate students. I have.
You were busy that day already.
That day was gone.
So it's worth probably just talking a little bit about the discovery which you won the Nobel Prize for. This was made in April 1982. And these were crystals that weren't quite crystals. So let's start from the beginning. What is it about matter, or crystals rather, that makes them special? And what did people think before you came up with your ideas?
Yeah. You know, all materials are made of atoms, and the atoms in crystals are ordered. That means there is a special way in which they organize themselves in an orderly fashion. That order is usually periodic. Periodicity is like tiles on the floor. There is some periodicity. If I take a few tiles off the floor, you will know where to put them again because you understand the order. And you understand the periodicity. Periodicity means that the distance between one tile to the other is exactly the same distance from that one to the one that follows. So this is periodicity. All crystals that have been studied from the year 1912, in which crystallography really started by an experiment by von Laue on X-ray diffraction, all these crystals that were studied for 70 years, hundreds of thousands of them, they're all ordered and therefore crystals, and periodic. There was no exception. And so over time, a paradigm was developed, and the definition of a crystal was, a crystal is a material in which the atoms are ordered and periodic. This was a crystal, because there was no exception. It did not come from theory. It came from hundreds of thousands of observations, and this was the definition.
So there was no reason to expect that something different would come along.
Absolutely. Yeah. There was no reason to expect that something different would come along. Absolutely. And so here I am, April 8, 1982, doing my sabbatical years at NBS, National Bureau of Standards, in Maryland, near Washington, D.C. And the alloy that I have prepared to be studied that day was aluminum 25 weight percent manganese, and it was rapidly solidified. And I studied it in the electron microscope. And immediately that morning, beautiful April morning, and I am there in the dark room with the electron microscope, I see a diffraction pattern. This is now an electron diffraction pattern, which has a forbidden symmetry, a tenfold rotational symmetry. This is forbidden. Later on, it was found out that the symmetry is really fivefold symmetry, not tenfold symmetry. But I had to do another experiment for that. It's called Kikuchi line experiment. That's a different style. So immediately I started to perform series of experiments to find in the electron microscope to find out what is the reason for that forbidden diffraction pattern. And I was thinking that it comes from crystalline defects called twins. And these twins separate the crystal into certain subcrystals which have a special relationship between them. This is why we call them twins. There is a boundary between them which is a mirror image. And I thought that these are five-fold twins, something that I have seen before in my career. I performed experiments in the electron microscope and there were no twins. I knew from day one that they were no twins. Why am I saying that? Because later on, eminent scientists claimed that these are twins, and I knew from day one there were no twins there.
Well, we'll come back to the criticisms later. Let me just go back to, you talked about five-fold symmetry. Just explain to us how you define symmetry in a crystal. Two-fold, three-fold symmetries, and why five-fold symmetry is so rare, or in fact was rare until you found it?
It was non-existent. Rare is mild. Yes. A rotational symmetry of a crystal is something that can be explained by the following example. Suppose you have a cube on the table. You can turn the cube 90 degrees to the right, and it will look the same. Nobody will know that you've changed it, right? And you can do it four times until it comes back to where it was before. So the cube, from this orientation, has a four-fold rotational symmetry. Periodic crystals can have one-fold rotational symmetry, which means the whole turn, two-fold, 180 degrees, 180 degrees, three-fold, 120, 120, 120, and four-fold, 90 degrees, 90 degrees, 90 degrees, and six-fold, 60 degrees. But no five-fold and nothing beyond six is allowed in periodic crystals. This is true. It was true before, it is true now. This is pure mathematics, pure geometry. It's okay. So here I am with a crystal with five-fold rotation symmetry, obviously something different. You know, I was a veteran electron microscopist by the time I did this study. I knew my electron microscopy and I trusted my electron microscopy. And I knew that there were no defects there in that structure. There were no twins. I know that because I performed the right experiments to prove. In fact, I was looking for them, and I thought, oh, I will record them and forget about it. Well, I couldn't find them. And so after performing these experiments, and it was maybe noon times or early afternoon, I knew that I have something different.
So less than a day, you knew you had something different.
Yes.
When did you tell your colleagues?
Immediately.
And what did they say?
Well, I showed them the pictures. Not only did I show them the picture, I discussed it with them, I showed them all my experiment, explained it to them, and asked them, what do you think about it? And some of them said, well, maybe an artifact. I knew it was not an artifact. I prepare my specimen very well, and I do my microscopy very well. No artifacts. So they didn't know. And this was also the answer of a computer, and I'll tell you about it. I did not only electron diffraction, but also X-ray diffraction and neutron diffraction. Everything was available there. At NBS, they have a nuclear reactor to do neutron diffraction. And that diffractometer had a computer attached to it, and you could feed in the peaks of the diffraction and ask the computer what it is. Of course, nowadays it's very well developed, but I'm talking about 1982. At that time, it was new. And I fed the peaks to the computer, and the computer said, I don't know. When I asked him what it is, he said, I don't know. Because the computer was designed to work on periodic materials, and this was not periodic. So, yes, it was clear to me that this is something new from day one.
So these things were eventually called quasi-crystals or quasi-periodic crystals. After you published the results, 2 years later, it took 2 years for the results to get into publication. What happened in that time? Were you already getting resistance from people?
Yes. Let me explain to you why it took 2 years, and then I will go back to the resistance of people. It took 2 years because although I knew what I do not have, I didn't know what I do have in my hands. And only when I came back to the Technion for my sabbatical, I met Professor Ilan Blech, who was willing to work with me on my results, and he proposed a model that could explain the formation of such quasi-periodic materials. And then we sent a paper for publication. The paper, we sent it to a journal called Journal of Applied Physics. The paper was rejected very quickly, and the editor recommended that I send it to a journal of people who are interested in metallurgy, metallurgy in England, which I did. The journal is called Metallurgical Transactions. They accepted it and published it, but they published it only in June of the next year, in June of 1985. And in the meantime, something else happened. In the meantime, I came back to NBS in the summer of 1984, showed my result to John Kahn, my host, and we had some discussions on that, and he proposed to do something else, to write a paper for fast publications to PRL, Physical Review Letters. He brought in Denis Gratias, a mathematical crystallographer from France, at the time in Vitry, near Paris. And then we published a second paper, but that paper was a quick publication, and in November of 1984, it was published. And then hell broke loose, because so many people from around the world repeated my experiments. I explained how to do that, and within a week, people had the same results. So during that week, the science started. Now, the name... The quasicrystals, which I don't very much like, because they are not quasicrystals, they are crystals of quasi-periodic order. And this is why I like to call them quasi-periodic materials rather than quasicrystals. This was proposed by Dov Levine, who together with Paul Steinhardt published a second paper and proposed a model different than the Ilan Blech model, which is the tiling model, based on Penrose tiles, but three-dimensional Penrose tiles. So it was Dov Levine who coined the term. I think that quasi-periodic materials is a better term, simply because they're not quasi-crystals, they're crystals.
That's what they are, quasi-periodic materials. It's a more descriptive... But I mean, these things that you observed, you observed them for the first time, and recorded them and published them. The idea of them, though, has been around for some time. You mentioned Roger Penrose. You mentioned the other sort of there are Arabic mosaics out there that have this sort of tiling pattern in two dimensions. Johannes Kepler, I believe, thought about aperiodic tiling as well. I mean, I wonder how much of these things did you know about when you were doing your work as well?
I knew about Penrose tiles. I knew about the Arabic Muslim mosaics.
I mean, I think that's an interesting example, actually, because for people who can't get their heads around what this stuff looks like, can you give them an example of the kinds of things in the mosaics that do have aperiodic tiling?
Well, I'm not sure that these Arab mosaics are quasi-periodic, but I'm almost sure that they did not mean to be quasi-periodic. It just happens that when you do a certain pattern, it becomes something that looks like quasi-periodicity, and it may be quasi-periodic. Penrose tile is a perfect example of quasi-periodicity, and Penrose is an eminent scientist who lives here in England, and he's a wonderful physicist, mathematician, thinker, science writer. I mean, he's an amazing person. And he proposed the Penrose tile, which is a perfect example of quasi-periodicity in two dimensions. Quasi-periodicity in one dimension is the Fibonacci series from the year 1202. But all these people did not think that materials can behave this way. These were mathematical games, if you will. Gardner in Scientific American publicized Penrose tiles in his column Mathematical Games. They were mathematical games, a wonderful thing. One step forward was made by Alan Mackay, also a British mathematician who lives in our time, and he showed that the Penrose tiles can form a sharp diffraction pattern, which was very interesting. Five-fold rotation symmetry diffraction pattern. But people didn't talk about materials that can be formed this way.
These were all theoretical constructs, games.
Yeah, there were patterns. geometrical patterns, be it the Penrose tiles or be it the mosaics. But people didn't say that there are materials like this. Nobody was looking for these materials. I stumbled upon this material when I was working on the development of aluminum alloys for aerospace applications.
Now, so you have this stuff now, and is there anything that quasi-periodic crystals, quasi-periodic materials can be used for? I mean, we don't want to say that everything, every intellectual development has to have some use immediately, but have there been uses for this thing, for this discovery?
Yeah. If you ask about applications for quasi-periodic materials, that depends, of course, on their properties. So if you want to apply some materials for a certain purpose, then you have to find a property which is unique, which is better than in other materials, and balance that against other properties. And if the price is right, then it can find some application. And quasi-periodic materials have interesting properties. For instance, they have low surface energy. That means that practically speaking, coefficient of friction of this material is low, and it means that they can serve as non-stick materials. If you make an omelet or a filet mignon on a frying pan which is coated with quasi-periodic materials, then they don't stick. So this is one property. Heat conductivity is poor in these materials. They are sort of insulators for heat conductivity. Electrical conductivity has interesting behavior, exactly the opposite, or almost exactly the opposite of superconductors. In superconductors, when you lower the temperature, the resistivity goes to zero. In quasi-periodic material, the resistivity goes up to a high value. So it's almost the opposite. And they have some interesting optical properties, magnetic properties. Okay, so this is the baseline. Now, what are they used for? Well, I mentioned frying pans. I can also mention to you that they serve as strengthening particles in a wonderful steel that the Swedish company Sandvik makes. And that steel is used whenever you need a stainless steel to touch the body, such as in electric shavers or operation room knives and other things that touch the body. Use that wonderful steel, and I assume that there are other uses because the properties of the steel are fantastic. So these are just two examples.
Now, you've already hinted at this, and we'll go into it in more detail now. When you initially submitted the paper to the Journal of Applied Physics, it was rejected because it seemed such an outlandish idea. And that was perhaps the start of many years of your colleagues and going all the way up to Linus Pauling and others saying that your ideas are quasi-science rather than real science. Now, in the length of time, people have been shown that that's not true. But take me through what happened in the years after. What kinds of response you got from people who didn't understand your work and thought it was, you know, rubbish science?
Okay, let me start in the beginning. In 1982, just after the discovery, I started to talk about my discovery and showed my results to people. These are pictures from the electron microscope. You can show it to people, you can explain them what you did, and you can ask for their opinion. And then I started to talk about materials that have five-fold rotation symmetry diffraction patterns with no periodicity. The diffraction pattern does not have periodicity on top of being five-fold rotation symmetry. And there are no twins there, because people who understood something in the field said, oh, Danny, this must be twin. I said, no, I know for sure, no twins.
You checked it.
Oh, on day one. So the reaction was varied. Let me give you the good reaction of my host, John Kahn. John Kahn said to me, Danny, this material is telling us something, and I challenge you to tell me what it is. Find out what does it tell us. This was the good reaction, encouragement. The bad reaction was the head of my laboratory, who came to my office one day and smiling sheepishly put a book on X-ray diffraction on my desk and said, Danny, please read this book and you will understand that what you are saying cannot be. And I told him, you know, I don't need to read this book. I teach at the Technion and I know this book, and I'm telling you my material is not in the book. So he took the book, came back a couple days later and said to me, Danny, you are a disgrace to my group. I want you to leave my group. I cannot be with you in the same group. So I left the group and went and found somebody else, another group leader that adopted the scientific orphan, and there was no big deal about it. It was not so traumatic as it sounds now.
Well, it sounds quite traumatic to have to leave your group.
I know, but it was not. You know, I didn't have to move away from my office or to shift to my laboratory. Everything remained the same. Practically speaking, instead of reporting to this secretary, I reported to that secretary. That was all the difference. And it took me 1 or 2 days to find another group leader that will adopt me. So now it sounds traumatic, but it was not that way at all. And but in between were the other reactions, in between a support, although not help to solve the problem, but support to total rejection. Later on, after the publication, then what happened was the following. First, a large group of eminent young scientists grew very rapidly to grow quasi-periodic materials and to find more quasi-periodic materials and to look at their properties and structure. And they took my discovery and made it into a science. And that community grew very fast, as of the end of 1984, almost immediately. On the other hand, there was resistance. And the resistance was from two main bodies. The first body was the International Union of Crystallography. That union is the body that governs everything that is accepted in the science of crystallography. They said the following, in not exactly in these words, but the message was, bring us X-ray diffraction results. We do not respect electron diffraction. But in order to get them X-ray diffraction results, I needed, or my colleagues needed, large enough crystals to perform a single crystal work on the X-ray machine, to get an X-ray diffraction pattern from a single crystal. You need a crystal of some size. That some size may be like a speck of sand, like a grain of sand. Something that you can feel between your fingers. We didn't have that because our crystals were micron in size and we needed a fraction of a millimeter. We needed something that will be 100 larger at least, or 1,000 larger. It took 3 years for us, the community, and the two groups in Japan and in France grew large enough crystals. They took X-ray diffraction from a single crystal, received wonderful, beautiful Lawet patterns, and they gave me the patterns, and I presented the results in 1987 in Perth, Australia, to the International Union of Crystallography. And then the people there said, okay, Danny, now you're talking. And they formed a committee that redefined crystals in a few years later. And now the definition of a crystal contains quasi-periodic material. It is a wonderful definition, a very humble definition, and the humble scientist is a good scientist.
So what was the definition of a crystal before, and what did it become?
Before it was, a crystal is ordered and periodic. A crystal is a material in which the atoms are arranged in a periodic fashion. The new definition says that a crystal can be either periodic and it can be non-periodic, and we are open to new discoveries. This is the spirit of the new definition. The new definition is a very humble definition, and it reads in very simple words. It reads almost like a poem. It's not a hardcore definition as you would expect from that hardcore body of science. So you would think that after the International Union of Crystallography accepted quasi-periodic materials, now this is it, this is the end of objection. Not so fast. Because then there was Linus Pauling. Professor Linus Pauling, an eminent scientist, two-time Nobel laureates, once in chemistry, one in peace. He stood on stages and claimed and said, and he stood on stages in front of thousands of people, and the American Chemical Society was behind him. And he said, Danny Schechtman is talking nonsense. There are no quasi-crystals, just quasi-scientists. And he proposed model of a periodic structure which is twinned. And I knew that there are no twins there, okay? But he insisted on that. And every time he showed another model and he published it, somebody in the world jumped up a few days later and said, Professor Pauling, you are wrong. It doesn't work. Your model doesn't work. And here is the proof. So everything he did was wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong. And eventually he couldn't publish so many of his papers, and they were rejected before they were published. But he was very insisting. He was very sure of himself, and he spoke. He was a flamboyant speaker. By the way, I met him several times, and we had wonderful conversations. We agreed about everything, vitamin C included, but never on quasi-periodic materials. Let me just finish by telling you the following. A couple of years before he died, he sent me a letter. Those days we were sending letters to each other, you know, with envelope and stamp and airmail. And the letter says, Professor Schechtmann, may I propose to you to write the joint Schechtmann-Pauling paper on quasi-periodic materials. And you will be first, he says. And I answered him with a letter, Professor Pauling, I'll be delighted to write this paper with you. But before we even start, we have to agree that quasi-periodic materials do exist. He wrote me back and said, well, that may be too early for that. And that was the end of our communication, and then he died, and that was...
What was he proposing to write in the paper then, if he didn't know?
I don't know. He didn't agree, you know. He wanted to pull me to his side, apparently.
So it's a salutary lesson for you as well, that just winning a Nobel Prize doesn't mean you're always going to be right, eventually. those years must have been difficult, because, as you said, Linus Pauling was and still is, in the history of science, a very important person, especially in chemistry. And so did you ever at any stage... even the darkest moment one day, think, you know, he might just be right. He's so convinced.
I knew from day one that he was dead wrong. But let me tell you an episode. One of my daughters, at the time in high school, came back home one day, and they studied about the atomic bond, and like the name Linus Pauling came up. And so my daughter says to me, Daddy, is this Linus Pauling who is vehemently against you? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, Daddy, he must be right. But he was wrong.
Now, after you won your prize last year, you wrote that every scientist who wants to make a definitive contribution to humanity has to know that he's right and stand his ground. And that's something clearly that you did after you made your discovery, and you were correct. But how do you draw the line between having self-belief and the sort of unscientific ideas some people have, the mavericks, if you like, that feel like no one's listening to them?
Yes, well, most sort of, as they're called, new discoveries are artifacts. Either experimental artifact, or people don't know the rules of physics and chemistry and mathematics. So most of what are called new discoveries do not stand the criticism of the scientific community. Now, that doesn't mean that we should not listen to new ideas. We should listen to new ideas, and we should criticize them and check them. And if they are wrong, we should say, okay, this idea is wrong. Now, let me give you an example. Among the hundreds of thousands of scientific articles that are written in literature, many, many of them are just nonsense. Although they pass the sieving mechanism of the different journals, these are nonsense. Or in most cases, if they are not nonsense, they do not add much to science. But some of them, just some of them, make a real revolution in science. And these are the scientific discoveries that make science progress and venture into new fields. And this is so nicely seen when you go through the list of Nobel laureates. You see the important discoveries each year. So this is the Nobel Prize, among other prizes, of course, but this is number one, and there is no second to the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize will tell you this is a magnificent discovery, and this is a magnificent discovery, and so on and so forth.
Are there any downsides to winning a Nobel Prize? Have you found anything particularly annoying?
Well, there are several downsides. Number one, you are taken away from your scientific work. Now, that depends on the character. Now, we have, you know, at the Technion, my university, we have three Nobel laureates. Some do not respond to almost any of the invitation to the world, and they are in their laboratory. Others do respond and are away from their laboratory. So one downside is that you are taken, most of your time is taken away from your scientific work. This is one downside. The other downside is that it's a mental and physical stress to travel from country to country endlessly, giving talks, speaking to people like you, journalists. So each one of these actions is like little nothing, but when you do it day in, day out, and it's all the time, and you fly from one country to another with a suitcase endlessly, it's a strain on the body and soul. So that's another downside. But then again, you know, as far as I'm concerned, because I feel like a missionary to promote education and science and technological entrepreneurship, for me, it's one big celebration. You know, when I see people responding to what I say, when I see young, bright eyes in the crowds, and when I tell them, let me give you an example, what I tell to the young listeners, students and such. I said, if you want to have a wonderful career, become an expert in something that you like. Become an expert. Become the best in your class. Find something that you like and become an expert in that. Become the best in your class, the best in your school, the best in your country. And I promise you that if you become an expert in something, you'll have a wonderful career.
And this is not just science you're talking about.
Absolutely. This is not just science. In everything, if you want to be a saxophone player, wonderful. But try to be the best. Try to be number one.
Is science a good career?
I think so. So much so that I recommend to my son, who is a physicist. I have four children, but little one is a son. The rest are girls, and they're all clinical psychologists, following the footsteps of their mother. My son is a physicist. He's finishing his PhD at the Technion. He studies nonlinear optics. And I encourage him to stay in academia. And if he's successful, I will be happy. I think it's good for him because he likes to teach. He likes to do research. So, yes, I do recommend it.
But what got you into science in the first place?
Ah, that's an interesting story. You see, when I was young, I read many books. And one of the books by Jules Verne, the French writer, it's called Wondrous Island, or something like this. And in that book, there are five people who are stranded on an island, and they create civilization, material civilization, from nothing, from whatever is available on that island. And the key figure in that book is named Cyrus Smith. He's an engineer. And he could do everything. He could do anything. And I wanted to be like him. So when I finished my military service after high school, I served for 2.5 years. Now it is 3 years in Israel. At the time it was 2.5 years. I was accepted to the Technion. And 4 years later, 1966, I became a mechanical engineer. And I was so happy. Finally, my dream came true. And then 1966 was a bad year. It was a big recession in Israel. I could not find a job. And after a while, I said, well, maybe I should do my master's degree. And in the meantime, 2 years later, I will find a job. But then I fell in love with science and decided to continue for my PhD. And from there on, I was a scientist.
What was your master's degree in that made you fall in love with science?
My master was in material science. I studied titanium alloys, some properties of titanium alloys. In fact, this was my PhD. My master's degree was on chromium diffusion coatings and their effect on fatigue properties of steels.
And it's then impressive you remember the title.
Yeah, well, such detail. That was many years ago. Oh, I do remember, of course. I think it was a very nice piece of work. I really loved that science. I was very inventive. I invented many techniques, how to study these materials and how to record the results. I was very happy as a young scientist.
I wonder if you've kept up with the Nobel Prizes this year. You've been busy, but the prizes were given to Brian Kobilka at Stanford University and Robert Lefkowitz at Duke University for discovering something called G-protein coupled receptors. This is very far from what you were doing. You're in materials.
You know, I learned about what they discovered. It's an amazing study. These are receptors in the cell that allow certain materials to get in and other materials not. It's an amazing functioning molecule. It's wonderful the way it works. So I know something about it, but I cannot comment on the quality. But I assume that, you know, if the Nobel Committee headed by Sven Lidin decided that they really deserve the prize, who am I to say? No, obviously, they did a wonderful job.
Well, also, the thing to note is that obviously they discovered the structure using X-ray crystallography. So that seems to be the reason that people get chemistry prizes these days.
Yeah. It turns out that prizes in crystallography are given by the chemistry prize.
So I want to just ask you finally, you know, it's impossible to predict these things, but who do you have any tips for future Nobel winners? And if not, how would a struggling scientist nowadays, how would you go about winning one?
Well, there are several conditions to get any prize, any scientific prize, and including, of course, the Nobel Prize. And you will be surprised to hear what I say. The most important factor and the most important action that has to be taken is to be nominated. If you're not nominated, you'll never get the prize. But of course, in the background, there should be an excellent, excellent science.
Professor Dan Jackman, thank you very much indeed.
You're most welcome.
That was Alok Jar in conversation with Daniel Scheckman, who won the 2011 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his discovery of quasicrystals. And if Alok has left you wanting more, you can read his profile of Prof. Scheckman in The Observer on Sunday at guardian.co.uk/science. That's all we have for you on this edition of Science Weekly. From me, Ian Sample, Alok Jar, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.